overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life. I am.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration Service for the Center of Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
Good morning. Excited to be here today. It's May, and I'm leaping into a whole new theme for this month. Normally, if we were here at the center, we would be handing out programs, but these are strange times, and we're moving into the new normal. Someone said the new normal is the new abnormal, and I'm beginning to think everything is so different now that it's just adjusting. We're adjusting to our whole sound system and cameras and computers. And so thanks for your patience as we get our act together. And it is coming together. And thanks, Michael and Jean, for showing up here with your lovely masks on. Provide me an audience of two. And so the theme for this month is a whole new world, because we're going to need a new world after this. And hopefully it's going to be a world where there's more connection with the human species, where we're not seeing ourselves as better than. We don't label some countries as asshole countries and other countries as superior countries. I heard that the lady at the CDC was fired because she had the chutzpah to say people from Europe were bringing the virus and it wasn't just China. So when you tell the truth, you lose your job. But I think it's time for people to tell the truth. And my friend told me that Pat Robertson said it was gay marriage that brought the pandemic here. And so that's not the truth, in case you don't know. And when you can see a lie for what it is and call it out, then hopefully, looking a little deeper, you can find something that is causative to our own suffering. A dear friend reminded me that some people are just stuck. They're stuck in a belief system. They're stuck in a way of perceiving things. And now it's requiring that we see things in a different way. Life is very, very precious right now. And we're getting a wake-up call on the planet. You know, it's funny, I went in for my physical. This was several years ago. Now I have them regularly. And they said I was pre-diabetic. And I thought, huh? Pre-diabetic? And then the nurse practitioner sat down with me and she explained that you have to watch your carbs. That means you can't have your pasta like you like to have. And if you want to eat your fruit, you have to restrict your fruit to things like blueberries and strawberries. You can't eat all the watermelon you want. And through the change in diet, you can manage this pre-diabetes. So my whole life changed through that simple diagnosis. My little sister is now type 2 diabetic. She has to wear a pump. It's serious. My brother died from diabetes. So what if it's not a bad thing? It's not we're being punished because we're a strange Norwegian-Swedish family. It's just something that we get to meet and hopefully have skillful ways of doing it and not get stuck in our resistance, stuck in our opinion that it's a bad thing. It's just a thing. I remember Mary Tyler Moore, who was on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, was diagnosed with diabetes like 30, 40 years ago. And she said it was the best thing that ever happened to her because she started changing the way she approached life. And her diet completely changed and she became a healthy woman. I guess our ex-president Bill Clinton had a heart attack and he's now a vegan. So what if what we're experiencing has the potential to make us more conscious in this world and maybe create a whole new world, where our meat packing companies will humanely raise the produce, the chickens and the pigs. And it's a demand on us to think differently. And even doing virtual church, I'm wondering if we'll ever come together and gather as people. But the good news that might happen is that we can reach a much larger audience through this virtual technology that I'm just beginning to experience. So thank you guys for helping us with this. My dear friend Lisa Ferraro, she has started a new ministry called Soul Call Ministries, and she interviewed me on Monday for a wise something on Wednesdays, and then she taped an hour, and then she broadcasted live streaming today. So I'm being live streamed from the Columbus, Ohio church and here in Huntsville, Alabama, because of this technology. So what if the potential is not to have a large audience, but in a strange sort of way to have more availability for people to witness us? There's this beautiful man, his name is Terry, and he lives somewhere in Mississippi. And he stopped here a couple of times, he said, and he just wishes that they had something like this in Mississippi. But now he can watch us on Sundays. He's on the class that we teach on Wednesdays, all because of this technology. So what if something good's coming out of this? And maybe we're just learning to see it. That's my question to you. So in this idea of the whole new world, it was inspired by a class that I've taught several times. I was thinking of teaching it again, but I'll just use this as an inspiration. It's called A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle. And the subtitle is Awakening to Your Life's Purpose. And so he quotes that beautiful line from Revelations, and he says, "And behold, the voice within said, there will be a new heaven and a new earth. And the voice within says, behold, I make all things new." So to create this new world, there needs to be a new heaven, which would be a new consciousness, in order for this new earth, this new manifestation in form to appear. And so in this lovely book, and it's just battered, it's been read so many times, I wanted to give you a highlight. Near the end of the book, he talks about waking up and how we're called to awaken to an inner purpose. And he says the inner purpose has to take precedent over the outer purpose. So the inner purpose is all about being. Who am I being? And the being then, the doing comes from the being. So here's how he phrases it. He has a lovely way of phrasing things. He says, our primary purpose in our life cannot be found on an outer level. It does not concern what you do in the world, but rather it concerns who you are. Huh. So I love Gene because he has this wonderful sense of humor. So when he goes to work, he's there to create joy. Yes, he does the deeds and he does all his work, fine, but he's there to smile and transmit that beautiful presence that he is. That is to say, your state of consciousness is more important than your actions. He's not discounting your actions. He says your life has an inner purpose and it has an outer purpose. The inner purpose concerns being, with a capital B, and it is primary. And the outer purpose concerns doing, and that, he says, is secondary. So it's a different way of approaching life. He goes on to say your inner purpose is simply to awaken. There is that which is within us that awakens when it's ready to awaken. It's not that David awakens or Gene awakens. It's this thing is already awake and it awakens, and we can't make it happen sooner than it's ready to happen. Gene and I were reflecting when we were at Ghost Ranch. We were in this beautiful vortex that was a strange, strange place. And when you'd look out the window, you'd see this mountain called the Paternal. It's just breathtaking. And there's some kind of transmission that takes place there. And when you go within and you listen to that still voice, it begins to reveal things. And it was at Ghost Ranch that I came in contact with that Chinook prayer that spoke to my heart. And it was like a wake-up call for me, because in the Chinook prayer said, I look at the Paternal, the mountain, and I say, teach me and show me the way. I look at the clouds that move over the landscape without attaching to it, and I say to the clouds, teach me and show me the way. You know, I look to the young girls and the children that walk in the back of the room with such innocence. And I say to these young people, teach me and show me the way. And then could I lowly listen for that guidance of the soul who's always seeking meaning in life, whereas the intellect wants answers. The soul doesn't seek answers. The soul seeks a meaning. So what if our challenge and opportunity and responsibility is to discover a meaning for each one of us during these times? These are serious times. I've spoken to my little sister who's in Oregon, and she's isolating, and she said her neighbor has the COVID virus. It could be right next door to you and you don't even know it. So it's time to not be flippant about it, but really take this thing seriously. So your inner purpose is to awaken. It is as simple as that. And you share that purpose with every other person on the planet. This isn't a Christian thing, a Jewish thing, a Muslim thing, it's a universal thing. Awaken now that sleepeth. That's why I told Michael that the title of the talk today is It's Time to Wake Up. And I've quoted William Stafford, the poet, who ends this very long poem with one simple last sentence. It's very important for those who are awake to stay awake, because these are very dark times. So if you have a glimmer of being awake, and Eckhart Tolle will explain what that means. He says your inner purpose is an essential part of the purpose of the whole. The universe and its emerging intelligence. So we can only have a new world when we have a new consciousness, and it starts with us. Your outer purpose can change over time. And God knows at age 71, my purpose has gone from here to there to there to here. And now I find myself sitting in a little chair. I bought this chair over 20 years ago when we moved to the center with the idea that I would be sitting in it when we'd have someone singing. So for 20 years, this chair sat in the back of the room. And now with the pandemic, it's finally found a place for me to sit. So when conditions are right, chairs can be used. Your outer purpose can change over time. So finding and living in alignment with your inner purpose is the foundation for filling any outer purpose. So the question is, are you happy? And you won't be happy when you get what you want. You'll be happy when you want what you have. So when I was a waiter in a little French restaurant, I was happy as a clam. And when I was a landscaper and working my back off, that nearly killed me, but I was happy as a clam because I was merging with the plants. So what if it's not what you do, but how you do what you do? Without this alignment to your true inner purpose, you can still achieve certain things through effort and struggle and determination and sheer hard work or cunning. And, you know, I was reading Anthony DeMillo in his lovely little book called Awakening, and he starts off with a chapter called Wake Up. And he says, the world doesn't want to wake up. They'd rather stay asleep. The Pat Robertson people would rather stay asleep rather than to have to change a belief system. They would rather believe that Adam and Eve are the first two men and woman and whatever, that Noah destroyed or God destroyed. And they want to believe that hardline way of thinking, and that's just the way they are. They don't want to wake up. So he tells a little story at the very beginning of his chapter in his wonderful book. He says the mother screams upstairs to her son, son, it's time to get up. It's time to go to school. He says, I don't want to go. She says, you need to go. No, I don't want to go. He says, come on now. And he says, I'll give you three reasons. The kids are nasty to me. It's not fun. And I hate it. And she says, well, let me give you three reasons that you do need to go. She says, you're 45 years old. You have a responsibility to grow up. And you're the headmaster. So, and that was supposed to be funny. But in essence, we don't want to wake up. We don't want to grow up. We don't want to take responsibility. We'd rather pule and blame somebody else. And this isn't about blaming anymore. I'm really so thrilled to see some of the way the governors, especially Governor Cuomo in New York City, when they said, how well did you do? Would you give yourself a good grade for how quickly you responded? And he said, you know, I did the best I could. I jumped on it as soon as I heard it was there. So what if in our humility we could say, maybe I wasn't perfect, but I did my best and I'm doing my best right now, instead of blaming somebody all the time. So here's how he explains this awakening, and it's a gradual awakening. He said, awakening is a shift in consciousness in which thinking and awareness separate. Now we did a class here, we do so many classes, that it was called Shift into Freedom by Locke Kelly. And he said, I used to go through my life thinking that I was this cloud all separate up there. And my job was to keep my cloud nice, white, and fluffy. Every now and then it would get all dark and cloudy when we're at turbulent times. And we can see there's a lot of storm clouds on the horizon. But then he said, one day I fell into the sky and went, holy cow, I'm the sky. I'm not the cloud. And yet I climbed back in my cloud because my cloud was my venue, my way of traveling through the sky. And it's where my belief system is. Well, awakening is kind of like that. We realize, oh my God, I'm this field of awareness. I'm not this local mind that has opinions and beliefs. I'm not stuck in that local mind unless I choose to be stuck, but I could choose to unhook from those thoughts. So the greatest part of spiritual practice is about unhooking from the egoic mind. And this is Eckhart Tolle's whole ministry. You know, he says we have this local mind, which is where we're stuck and often tyrannizes us. He says, but then we also share what he calls the no mind. You might call that the awakened mind, the open-hearted awareness. He says, imagine how your life would unfold if you were being and living in the no mind. There wouldn't be an agenda. There wouldn't be a belief system to be stuck in. You'd be free from the get-go. And then things would arise like COVID virus or pandemics or fears or concerns. And you would meet it consciously. You would meet it with intention and a sanity. Right now, there's an insanity in the world. And at the end of Anthony DeMillo's, he said, could we trade our insanity for sanity? What would a sane world look like? How would we treat one another in a sane world? Wouldn't every child be precious to us? Every child, every animal, you know? In the calendar, I was changing all the calendars here at the center. Trey, my husband, donates to a lot of rescue organizations. And so in the men's room, this rescue organization said, grow your gardens for nature. And all the animals are, and in a sense, this is the Garden of Eden, our planet. And I have these beautiful gardens at home. And what I've come to realize is it's being overtaken by animals. I've got an explosion of chipmunks, and they're climbing the trees. They're eating at the bird feeders. They're burrowing under the house. Bunny rabbits have now decided to come to my beautiful garden. They're hopping down the path. They're eating all the little vegetables. And I've decided, you know, we get to share this planet, me and the animals. It's not just mine, and I'm supposed to exclude those that are inconvenient, but rather it's all part of this beautiful garden we share. So he says, awaken to the awareness as your true self. He says, this new state of consciousness gradually flows into and transforms everything that you do, and so becomes integrated into your life. When this new way of seeing things, you're not your thoughts, you have your thoughts, but you can choose other thoughts, or you can choose to let the thoughts go away. I listen every Saturday night for inspiration to Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is doing a live streaming over the planet, 120 countries, over 20,000 people. And mostly he just sits there in silence. And he says, we're here to tend to, and he calls the most beautiful word is attending. Attending the moment, whatever arises in that moment. And he says, when you're attending to it, from that mindful awareness, from that beautiful spaciousness, from that sky of mind, a storm cloud of fear might come in. Oh my God, is it safe to go in the nursing home? My grandmother's there, da 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 da. And instead of letting that storm cloud grasp you and rain on you, you just see it moving through the sky of mind and it moves up. Then you are setting yourself free from the tyranny of thought, and yet you know thoughts will still arise. You're not bound by them. So instead of being lost in the thinking, he says, when you are awake, you recognize yourself as the awareness that is behind the thought. When Thich Nhat Hanh, one of my teachers 20 years ago, when fear would arise, he had this beautiful little saying. He'd say, oh, there you are, my little fear. There you are, my little fear. And then fear was invited in. We're doing a class on Wednesdays, and it's wonderful. It's called the Joy of True Meditation. And the whole premise of that class is true meditation is inviting whatever is in, attending the moment, you might say, attending the moment. And so fear comes in, oh, there you are, my little fear. Sadness comes in, oh, there you are, my little sadness. Can I allow myself to feel it without drowning in it? And then they give us this acronym in this way of teaching. The acronym is RAIN. Those four letters mean something. The R is recognize what's arising in the moment. You're this field of awareness, and in this moment, maybe there's a nausea in the stomach's arising. Maybe there's a flutter in the heart that's arising. Maybe there's an anxiety that's there. So you recognize what's arising. That's the R. The A is you allow it. You don't try to numb it. You don't, in an addictive society, we try to medicate ourselves from it. No, we don't need to medicate. We don't need to take some pill to make it go away. We can say, there's sadness. I don't need to get drunk. There's a fear. I don't need to take my bath. It's just fear. Fear will run its course. So we allow it. And then the I is we get intimate with it. We investigate. We get interested in it. You know, this anxiety seems to come up every time this thought is there. What if I didn't think that thought anymore? That so-and-so is a real pain and such-and-such, and every time I think that, I spiral out in some kind of reaction. What if by just investigating this emotion that I've allowed, I can see there's a causal thing behind all that? It's every time I think about the president, I get upset. Well, could I not think about the president? I don't have to think about him all the time, you know? And so the I is interesting. Get intimate with it, investigate it, inquire into it, and then the N is nurture yourself in this. Love yourself. I shared with you on these previous, want to call them podcasts. I live with a little song, a chant by Karen Drucker. It helps me, and maybe it'll help you. I invite you to say it sometimes or sing it. She says, I will be gentle with myself. I will be gentle with myself. And I'll hold myself like a newborn baby child. I will be tender with my heart. I will be tender with my heart, and I will hold my heart like a newborn baby child. This is that nurturing phase. And then she says, and I will only go as fast as the slowest part of me feels safe to go. and I'll only go as fast as the slowest part of me feels safe to go, because I'm nurturing myself now. I'm being gentle with myself. What if we could do that for each other? You know, my little pug miraculously has recovered from herniated disc in his neck, where he was paralyzed from the neck down. And I recognized that I wasn't able to fix him. I wasn't even able to help him, but I could serve him. And when he was paralyzed, I would put little droppers of water in his mouth because he couldn't drink. And then he couldn't eat, so I would take little pieces of turkey and put some, and he was so constipated, they said, give him some pumpkin. So I put the pumpkin in the turkey, made a little ravioli, and put his pain medication so he could take it. And he loved the smell of the turkey. And so I could kind of put it to his lips, and he would eat the turkey pumpkin pill thing. I would squirt the water in his mouth, put a little bit of CBD oil in there, thinking it might help with the pain. And so I was serving this pug. I was sleeping by his side. And for 3.5 days, I was his servant. That didn't mean that I wasn't afraid. And through the miracle of surgery and a lot of money, he is now able to walk like a drunken sailor. But you know, even a drunken sailor pug is better than a pug that couldn't walk. So when he walks down the street, he staggers from side to side, but he can move. And so, you know, you learn to be gentle with the pug. He can't walk far, so I've got him a stroller. And now he rolls down the street looking so regal because he's adapted to his situation. He's not complaining about it. He's not blaming somebody. In fact, he's probably never been happier because he doesn't have to do much. He gets served by his humanoids. So instead of being lost in your thinking, when you are awake, you recognize yourself as the awareness behind it. And awareness takes over. And thinking goes in the background. Thinking becomes then the servant of awareness. Every Sunday when I come here, I seek to let my thoughts be in service to the deeper ideas that I'm seeking to express, like to discover what this inner purpose is. So could my thoughts then be the handmaidens to this open-hearted awareness, so that I can then be that, and then in being that, do what's necessary in the world to effectively share that. So he says, thinking becomes the servant to awareness, and awareness is the conscious connection with universal intelligence. Awareness is the conscious connection with universal intelligence. Another word for this is presence, with a capital P. Consciousness without thought. Wow. We have a poster in the men's room that's Albert Einstein, big picture of Albert Einstein, says, I don't want to know what man thinks. I want to know what God thinks. In the science of mind, they talk about the universal mind, the big U and the big M, and then there's the little local mind. Could our local mind be a conduit for the divine mind? Now, the divine mind, one thing it doesn't have, and when I study with the Sufis, they say, you know what God doesn't have? The one thing that you could give God, the one thing that God doesn't have is your problem. So why don't you give it up to God? Huh? It's just a play around thing. Because God doesn't have that problem. You have that problem because you believe in it. You identify with it. So what if this infinite mind knows nothing of your successes? They're just a bunch of hoopla that's fluffed up your ego. Knows nothing of your failures. Oh, ain't it awful, stuck me. Infinite mind knows nothing of that. Could we let that mind be our mind? Let it flow through our consciousness. Jesus was there. He said, I myself do nothing. It's the infinite creative intelligence that does it all. Right? He knew that. That's why he said, love your enemy, because he realized it was just a projection of your own mind. He understood the psychology of consciousness, and that's why he's such a great example. Jesus was not meant to be the great exception, as so many of the Christians. Like, I remember having an argument with somebody. I say, isn't it enough? It was a Christian. I said, isn't it enough to know that the Christ lives in all of us? And he said, no, that is not enough. You have to have Jesus himself as your personal savior. I said, but Jesus was the example. He pointed the way. I said, my teacher said, you know, all the great teachers are pointers to the truth. You don't want to worship their finger. You want to look what they're pointing to. And what they're pointing to is this divine mind, this infinite creative love that is available to all of us. My beloved friend Lisa Ferraro in Columbus, Ohio, is doing a class on Rumi, and she's asked me to help her on the last class. And, you know, Rumi knew that. He used to phrase the infinite mind as a field. And he would say, out beyond the ideas of right thinking and wrong thinking, that's your local mind, there is this field. That's the awakened field. And he says that when the soul lies down in that field, you can feel it right now. It's that stillness. It's the no mind of Eckhart Tolle. It's the infinite mind of the universe. When the soul lies down in that field, words are not necessary. Words come from a construct of the ego. He says, even the idea each other does not exist. I will meet you there. You know, in Buddhism, all the teachings, all the spiritual teachings are saying the same thing. In Buddhism, they have a concept called emptiness. And what emptiness is that when you really deeply look into the mirror, you realize that if David's looking in the mirror, there is no David there. There's life there. There's this infinite intelligence there that's using the vehicle of David, but David's the impermanent. And David's gone through so many choices and so many different characters in his life. They're all empty. They're all part of the dream. But behind the dream is this essence self that we all share. Goethe, you know, I think of my new class, I've been debating on it for June. I think I'm going to do a class that's based on a Sufi concept called catching the thread. And that's the thread of truth. And everybody has pointed to the same thing. There is this something that we all share. And they're all pointing to that. This one points to that. That one points to that. But it doesn't matter until we catch the thread. We have to catch the thread. As Oliver Wendell Holmes says, the truth is incontrovertible. So the truth is there. And there's another little saying that says, the facts are the enemy of the truth. We want to get mired in the facts. But the truth knows nothing of the facts. The truth is incontrovertible. Could we want the truth more than that drowning man wants that gasp of air? And if you want the truth, and the truth is revealed to you, it'll probably piss you off. My teacher used to say, the truth sets you free, but first it pisses you off. Sorry if I'm using that phrase, but I'm just quoting him. Why does it irritate you? Because the truth says the only reason you're stuck is because of your stinking thinking. It's because you believed in a limited idea. It's because you've been so caught up in the container of the egoic pain body that you haven't realized that just by letting that go, even for the briefest time, that your true nature is freedom. The infinite mind isn't burdened by thoughts and opinions and a conditioned mindset. That's only you and me. And when we're empty of me, then we become the we. There's a poster in my neighborhood at Five Points that says, let's move from me to we. And that's so profound. Could you catch the thread on that? The we says we're all in this together. And maybe that's the beautiful thing about these times. When we know we're in it together. And Jesus said this, if you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me. We're at that place right now. What we do to the planet, we do to ourselves. If we pollute our streams, we're polluting our life. If we pollute the air, if we create animals that have all kinds of viruses, we're imbibing them, we're eating them. So, you know, yeah. Oh, anyway, he says, the initiation of the awakening process is an act of grace. You cannot make it happen, nor can you prepare yourself for it or accumulate credits toward it. It's not like when I say it's time to wake up, that there's something that you can do to do it. That which is awake is already there. Now, how does that which is already there learn to run the show in your life? By turning your attention toward that, by attending to it. Like John Kabat-Zinn said, by befriending the silence. The silence is always there. Even if it's for a brief moment, to just be still. You know, there's no anxiety. Now you can get stuck in the local mind and come back and want to have a narrative. You know, the thoughts are auditioning for your attention. Oh, think me, think me. Oh, think me, I'm a really stinky, icky thought. They're auditioning. They want you to go there. And the pain body loves to surface because it loves attention. You know, I was in a 12-step group called Codependence Anonymous, and I finally had to leave the group because it became a puling session. Every time I would go, it was like everybody was arguing for their limited idea. And I realized I would rather sit in a group and meditate than go to a place where everybody's identifying with their problem. And after a while, I heard this voice in my head said, if you argue for the limited idea, it's yours. And so many people don't want to let go of the limited idea. It's just a thought. So he's saying this awakening happens when we become still. And oftentimes it happens when a loved one dies. It happens when we're powerless. I love that first sentence of the 12-step program. I found myself powerless. That's a great place to be. Then you can surrender to something that isn't powerless. And then that something can reveal itself. But it does require a letting go of an obtuse identity with struggle, with me, with that whole human dance that he says. He says, there is nothing you can do about awakening. Oy vey. Lastly, he says, suddenly there is an awareness that is aware of thought, but it is not part of thought. And this is what an awakened person would be like. Awareness is the space in which thoughts exist when that space has become conscious of itself. Consciousness conscious of itself. So we could just stop for just a second and feel the stillness and observe if thoughts arise. And if thoughts arise, you've already shifted from the awareness of the thought, the witness of the thought, and the thought doesn't have you. You see the thought moving through, and you can say, that's an interesting thought, but I'm not going to follow it. And that thought just leaves like a cloud leaves the sky. And the better you get at this skill with your own thinking, the better you are in the world. Lastly, he says, once you've had a glimpse of awareness or presence, then you know it firsthand. And you can, lastly, opening yourself to this emerging consciousness and bringing its light into this world then becomes your primary purpose in life. Bringing this light, bringing this awareness into the world. And then how are we going to do that, Michael? How are we going to do that, Gene? I don't know, but there's something greater than me that does know. We're bringing the light into the world. Eckhart Tolle. So I was sharing with you, I was practicing or working on this new idea for a class, and Anne-Marie Lang shared a little book that I had taught 20 years ago called Healers on Healing. And I thought, what a wonderful book. And I pulled it out of my bookcase and I started going over it. And I said, no, I don't think I want to dive into healing right now. So then I went to my bookcase and I found the brand new book of Mark Nepo. It is called Drinking from the River of Light. And it's kind of what this says. Once you realize that we're light beings, and we're here, our purpose is to bring this light to the world. In order to do that, I have to be constantly accessing that river of light. So I pulled out that book yesterday and I'm strategizing how might the light use me to teach that in a new class and perhaps inspire these live streamings. And I realized it was more like an advanced level for a mystic. And I don't think most people are there. So then I went in, listening to that field of awareness, reflecting on that lovely book that Anne-Marie had turned me on to. And then I thought, what was your favorite book in the past where the rivers of light were speaking? And then all of a sudden, from that recesses, came this idea of For the Love of God. And it was a compilation of some of the greatest spiritual people on the planet. And they spoke about our relationship to this love that we all share. And the first one was His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And the second one was Mother Teresa. And I thought, instead of me assisting people in drinking from the river of light, what if each one of us could take communion with the rivers of light in expression? And so I think I'm going to do For the Love of God, where we will get to hear the light speaking through the Dalai Lama. We will get to hear the light speaking through Mother Teresa, and then notice where there is a resonance. Because I learned this strange thing 30 years ago when I was studying Ralph Waldo Emerson. And he's very, very challenging for most people to read because a sentence can be a page long. And he writes in a way that unless you have the capacity to go really deep, it's like over your head. And I had many disgruntled students complaining about that. So being a student of his first and then later teaching it, I came to this realization, the only way that I can understand Emerson is to know that the mind that wrote it is the mind that's reading. And so he would access that river of light. He would say, there is a stream whose source is hidden. And from whence it comes, I know not. But when it comes in its fullness, and I am a pensioner. I draw from that stream, that Orphic voice. So he was, through his example, showing. And so I had to know that that same mind that he was using is the same mind that I share. So when we hear the Dalai Lama, it's the same mind. There's only one mind. It's the infinite mind. Could we tune into it and then receive the transmission? Again, we're all catching the thread. When I studied with Thich Nhat Hanh, the very first thing he did, my mother had died maybe 10 days before that. My teacher died a week after my mother, and I was really grieving, but I had made this arrangement to go up to upstate Vermont and a 10-day silent retreat in the middle of grief, and there were maybe 1,000 people, and there was a sign on the wall, you have arrived, you are home. I ended up buying it for the center. And the first thing he did was, he sat there in his little brown robe and he moved his hand back and forth against his heart. And he said, all of life is a transmission. He said, there is a transmitter, and there is a receiver, and there is that which is transmitted. And then he said, your parents do nothing less than transmit themselves to you. They live in you. Your teachers do nothing less than transmit themselves to you. They live in you. And in that instant, I realized that's the whole game of wax. We all affect one another. We need each other to walk each other home. The peace that I am, Gene and I share this hope for the planet. It's not my hope. It's not his hope. It's the hope. And you know, in religious science, they say, we don't hope for things. We know, we state, declare. Well, I'm sorry. Hope is a beautiful way of saying, I hope humanity awakens to how precious life is, what a privilege it is to be here. Marcus Aurelius was on my Zen calendar the other morning, and it spoke to my heart. You talk about catching the thread, the transmission. This is, I'll paraphrase. Marcus Aurelius said, when I arise every morning, I say to myself, what a privilege it is to be alive. What a privilege it is to be able to think what I choose to think and enjoy life as it is. And I thought, wow, is this not relevant for today? And then the other day, Mary Oliver, who was a favorite of my beloved Etika Luckett's, she spoke to me, and I brought it here today. She said, Mary Oliver, this is the first, wildest, and wisest thing that I know, that the soul exists and that it is built entirely out of attentiveness. There's that word, attending. The soul exists and is built entirely out of attentiveness. Now, the soul is the eternal part that was never born and never dies. I received a text from Sharon Albright this morning, and I had given her some tomato plants. And I sent her some photographs because she used to house sit with the animals. And now we've lost half of the animals. So I sent her a picture of Humphrey and Bert. And she responded back, oh, Bert, Humphrey's so old. He's got gray in the beard. He looks so wise. And of course, Bert is so sweet. And I said, well, there's only two left. And then she said, but the other two live in them. There's that transmission again. And then after a few minutes, another text came, and she said, my beloved cat, Rusty, made his transition. And when he was leaving, all of a sudden, the kid's cat, Turtle, started acting like Rusty. I swear to God, Rusty's spirit went into Turtle. And we know what happened to Bert when Baby Speck died. All of a sudden, Bert came just like Baby Speck. He was chasing the ball. He'd never, ever chased a ball. He would even throw the ball at you, which was what Baby did. He never had thrown the ball. So what if there's this mystery of belonging when we're attentive, that we can see things, that what we are is a spirit that was never born and never dies. That's what we are. Yet we're here in this temporary phenomenon, but it takes a different way of looking at life. So the invitation, in order to get a whole new world for all of us, is going to ask that we begin to see the world in a different way. Not as an object for our abuse and for our possession and our acquisition, but a place that we share together, more like a garden, where we tend the garden, we serve the garden. And when we serve the garden serves us. Have you noticed when the human activity has been diminished on the planet, all of a sudden you can see the Himalayan mountains that were never seen for 20 years because the pollution is not there. The canals in Venice, the dolphins are back. My little sister said in Oregon on the beaches, the caribou are running on the beaches. They haven't been there for years. The planet is restoring herself when the human virus backs off a little bit. You know, imagine, you look at the streets of Paris and they're empty. And now you see them in China and they're buzzing with people. I don't know if it's safe right now for us to do our anthill around each other. I'm getting used to this separation because I want to be here to look in your eyes. And I'm going to learn the new normal is that I'm going to embrace you with my eyes, not throw my arms around you like I used to do in the past. So touchy-feely David's going to have to find a new way to make a quarter turn. I wanted to give you an inspiration from an awakened person. And I pulled out an old friend of mine, Mark Nepos, The Way Under the Way. Each one of us has to find the way that works for us. And he's a poet, and he's had the life experiences of cancer twice, and it transformed him. It helped him see with a new way. And so he invites us, he provokes in us that awakened self that can just begin to just see, could this, what's happening on the planet, be here for humanity instead of against humanity? Is this the wake-up call we've been needing all along? It's just a different way of approaching it. And he wrote this beautiful poem or the same, and it's called the quarter turn. And it evokes something in me. So I'm going to share it with you. He starts by quoting Helen Luke. And Helen Luke said, "I suddenly knew I was looking at it from the wrong angle. And I gave the cloth in my hand just a simple quarter turn. Immediately, I saw a beautiful and coherent golden pattern. In wonder, the pattern had emerged, to be seen in all of its beauty by those who could learn to make a simple quarter turn." To just be able to just shift so subtly. Oh my God, this is how we're coming together as a species. The greatest thing I hear on the news is that we're all in this together, every one of us. If you're in New York City, in the hospitals, if you're in Iowa, if you're in Kansas, if you're in LA, we're all in this together. It's not that anyone is immune. So he shares his little poem about his own evolution and the quarter turn in a very poetic, artistic sort of way about who he used to be and how who he is now. So I'm going to read it. It's very evocative. You might want to take the images for you if you want to close your eyes, because it's very visual. He says, "When I was 6 years old, I'd watch frogs and squirrels and lots of little birds, sparrows, titmice, chickadees. Something in how they moved seemed a secret. Once, when I was a little boy, I chased a butterfly halfway through a reservoir before cupping it in my boyish hands. I had this beautiful butterfly, but I couldn't see it. In order to see it, I'd have to let it go. So I kept my hands cupped as long as I could, past my nose's itching and my leg jiggling. And then the dark fluttering against my palms made me open my hands, and magnificent plates of color lifted against my will. It was way too delicate a story to tell over dinner. And soon there were books that I had to read and assignments I had to do and model cars to glue and arguments and anger, and I forgot. It's only now, 40 years later, that this memory awakens in me. Now it seems a way of life. Afraid to lose, we catch, we chase, we cling, and in the clinging, we are lost. It seems so obvious, once seen, like the face of God that's discovered in a stone, never just a stone again. Oh, what we feel beats darkly within us, only lifting the instant that we let go. Oh, what we feel, this quarter turn, this presence within, it beats darkly within ourselves, only uplifting the instant that we let go." So he did the quarter turn. He stopped thinking that, you know, when I was a little boy, we used to catch lightning bugs and we put them in a bottle. Now I would never do that, because they would always end up dead the next morning in the bottle. To see a beautiful butterfly, I'd use that metaphor of the butterfly in relationships, because people approach relationships like it's something that they want to cling to and grasp. She's my woman, he's my man, no one's going to ride my bike, all this possessive grasping holding. And so I would say to the couple, I say, think of love like that butterfly that you talked about. And a butterfly, which is this beautiful, fragile love, lands on your hand. It's chosen to land on your hand. If you close your hand around it, you're going to kill that butterfly. But if you keep your hand open, that butterfly can choose to be with you. And then it can choose to fly from flower to flower. But ultimately, it's so sweet on your hand, it's going to come back. What if we could approach relationships like that? Instead of grasping or clinging, our belief systems are like that. We don't want to grasp to a belief system, because what you believe today, you may not believe tomorrow. I know that's true for me. I used to be one of these hardcore religious scientists that believed that you had a mental equivalent of what you wanted. And now I always treat for the highest good, because sometimes what I want isn't the highest good. You know, sometimes what I want is for everything to be back to normal. Well, maybe the highest good is for it not to be that way. The highest good is for things to fall apart, so that they could repair in a way that doesn't look the way it used to. It's not about going back into a relationship and trying to repair it. Sometimes that relationship has worked its way out and it's evolving into a new way of being. Could we have that kind of life? We had a book in our bookstore, and I brought it home and I was going to teach that. It was called Spontaneous Evolution by Bruce Lipton. But it was so gloom and doom about the planet in its prognosis that we are on a course of our own destruction. And unless we consciously evolve, we as a species, we as a planet may not be here. I find that that's too programming of my subconscious. It's coming from the desperation, and I'd rather come from the optimism and the hope. You know, when I come from hope, then I can think of who could I be, and then how could I let my doing serve that being? So from what I've discovered, the best being for me is to be a loving presence on this planet, for me to be a listener, not only for the still small voice within, but to be able to listen to a friend and to be able to hear what's not being said. Sometimes what they're saying is the story they tell, but underneath the story, there's something so much deeper. Maybe under their anger is a pain, and by deep listening, I can hear that pain that's being masked by anger and rage and opinion. So what if this is a lifelong endeavor to change the world within me so that this world out here, and it's a work in progress, it's not a destination you get to. And my beautiful friend Michael Beckwith says, if you think you have the idea of how it should look, it's already too small because your mind can't conceive it. So could we surrender to this uncertainty and to know that in that uncertainty, something so magnificent potentially could arise, but it has to start within the hearts of humanity. Starts right in your own backyard, creating your own island of decency. When Gene looks out that window and smiles at someone, it starts right there. He doesn't have to fix them, he doesn't have to help them, but he can serve them by his example because there's a transmission from heart to heart, from eye to eye, from soul to soul. And it's palpable, it really is. So lastly, I'm going to close with a little meditation prayer and share with you what always seems to awaken me. My muse, my lover, is my garden. And Lisa Ferraro interviewed me this week, and she said, you've spoken about falling into flowers, David. And you have a unique way of communicating with the divine. And I said, well, it's funny you should say that. One of my earliest memories was being a little boy sitting on a golf course holding a flower, and I saw myself as not different from that flower. But then when you go back and try to tell the adults, they thought you were certifiable, so you learned to keep your little flower secrets to yourself. And anytime that I was experiencing that oneness, I had the same thing with the turtle once. You don't want to tell the world that the turtle and I are one, or the flower and I are one, so you kind of stay closeted to your own little inner mystic. It's very interesting. Mystics are the ones that see things in wholes, that everything is connected. Other people are kind of doctrinaire. They think things are separate. This is a right way, that's a wrong way. A mystic sees everything is interconnected. Everything's a part of you. Then could the tree in me awaken? Could the koala bear in me awaken? Could the whale? I like looking at these beautiful, dare I call them beasts, elephants and giraffes and I saw this little retrospective on Jane Goodall. It's 50 years since she went over to, I think it was the Congo, where she was a scientist and she was to study the great apes. And when she went in to study the great apes, the first thing she did was give them names, Coco and Jane. And the powers that be said, you're supposed to give them numbers, not names. And she said, I was castigated by the scientific community. 50 years later, she said, they said they were wrong. By giving them names, they became sentient beings. They were just not an animal. They had feelings. They had relationships. They were mothers and sons. And she said, I saw the complexity of the social structure of the apes by knowing and treating them as if they were sentient. A sentient being is someone who has feelings, not just a dumb animal that we can use for our purposes, but they have feelings. So she evolved to that place. And what is it going to take to awaken us to our interconnectedness? For me, it's the garden. So years ago, I was given a little book by Mary Ellen Edgar at the time called The Gardener. And it's written by a man named Groom or Grian. He's a Spanish poet. So you really can't get this book. It was translated into English. And it's all about a gardener and his mystical relationships with everything. And they're all just beautiful, but I picked one yesterday, sitting in the garden. It's called The Mystery of Life. And I'm going to use this and launch into a meditation. So this is more imagistic. Take it and feel into it and see it get us that quarter turn. If this can awaken something in you, if you know, it's kind of tricking that part of us that's awake to wake up because we're so used to being asleep in me, in my opinions, my beliefs. And that which is away from the infinite creative divine mind, the divine imagination, sometimes needs an image. So here's the gardener in his garden, awakening to the great mystery of life. And see if you can find your own revelation. He says, it was in the middle of a warm peace on a summer's day. The woodland was decorated, its soul, with a framework of bright lights, created by the sun in its attempt to break through the thickness of the forest. He says, the warmth, sensitive as a friend's hand on your shoulder, seemed to invite our gardener to rest in the shady place by the spring. All his effort and all his doing and all his hard work were now behind him. The meaning that had led his life up until that moment was stretched out at the end of this summer nap. And the sum of his successes and his failures simply vanished like a butterfly in the thickness of the forest. With a gaze of peace and tranquility and an open, naked heart, the gardener leaned back on the trunk of the old elm tree, drawing in the breath of the forest into his lungs. And in a moment that seemed an eternal moment, a pine cone from the old pine tree threw itself from the tree that gave it life and fell swirling toward a shady spot on the fertile ground. With two trembling tears appearing in the gardener's eyes, and in a quiet voice that only he could hear, he said to the tree, "Thank you, sweet Mother Pine Tree, for showing me the deepest mystery of life. Thank you, Mother Pine Tree, for showing me the deepest mystery of life." So I invite you to close your eyes and in the attending to this image, intuit what the gardener might have felt when he saw the seed fall from the tree, the mother letting go of her seed, her child, letting it drop into the ground, not attached to whether it would root, but simply letting it go, a part of herself, no longer clinging to it, but knowing that it is time for her to share something as intimate as her own seed. And so we see ourselves sitting in the silence together, me in a chair, you in virtual world. Our eyes are closed, and we are waiting. Just waiting in the silence. Observing the breath as a beautiful thread. Completely exhaling our breath, we notice that the inhale comes not with our doing, but it's as if the breath is giving itself to us. And breath in the mystical tradition means spirit. So what if this breath that we breathe is spirit? And when we incarnate as a baby, we incarnate on the breath. And when we leave this planet in form, spirit leaves with an exhalation on the breath. But that which breathes was never born and never dies. And so life is intelligent, and life reveals her secrets when we say, "Teach us and show us the way, pine tree. Teach us and show us the way, butterfly. Teach us and show us the way, O heart of mine, that breaks so easily." And so we practice recognizing what is right now in our lives. We don't push it away. We don't try to fix it, make it wrong. We just recognize it. And And we hear Emerson saying to us that prayer is the contemplation of what is with a jubilant, a grateful heart. Jubilant, meaning that there is optimism, hope, grateful. I can see clearly now where I was stuck. I can see the obstacles to my loving now. And so in this recognition of what is, even if it's a painful recognition, we are that beautiful field of awareness observing that. But we no longer make it wrong, because now we're being embracing, gentle with ourselves, nurturing to the abandoned little one within us. And we allow for our pain body to be heard, because we're deeply listening to it now. And once it's heard, it doesn't need to scream for attention, because we're intimate with it. We're intimate in the moment with whatever is. The unawakened part of ourselves is being embraced by the awakened part. That which is asleep is being held in that which is awake. That which is dark and afraid is being flooded with light and clarity, because we are intimate now with what is and with the world as she is, because we're not separate from the world any more than we're separate from a flower or a butterfly. And then the last thing, the acronym of RAIN, we nurture. We nurture first the self, because this is the one life that we've been given. And then we nurture those that are close to us. What a blessed, blessed community we have here at the center. And by the way, thank you all for sending in your tithes, whether it's through mail or PayPal. I feel loved every time I see a ding on there that says someone has given $5 and $10. Everything helps in tending this garden. And so we are here to nurture one another, to let each other know that I'm here. I may not be able to hold you in my arms, but I can hold you in my heart. If you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me. And so we start locally, but we know that this is a global revolution and evolution, where the human species is the one that's required to evolve. I know that each one of us is up to this task. The very fact that you're listening to this tells me you are. So we meet in that awakened heart, a heart that's filled with compassion, an awakened heart that is curious, how can I serve? An awakened heart that is not afraid to feel deeply both the pain and the joy of life. We rest as this awake awareness. Taking another deep integrating breath. Give a sigh for the divine. Ah. Join with me in the heart salutation, imagining that we're all here. And say with me, I honor you. I respect you. I love you. You are an aspect of myself. The beloved in me bows to the beloved in you. In this place, we are one. Feel the oneness, open your hands. Let your fingers move into the air. Send that vibrational love out into the universe. I can feel your love wrapping around me like beautiful golden light. This is how we do it now in virtual world. Thanks for tuning in. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, visit our website at www.cslhuntsville.org. To create a brand new world.